The next half hour brings the second program in the series on the Native Arts and Literature Conference that was held last December in Sitka. I'm Bo Osley, and welcome to Potlatch. Nathaniel Tarn is a poet from the Lower 48 who attended the conference. He talks about Native possession of cultural material and art.
Material poverty is one thing, and we are, of course, clear, and it must be absolutely clear, that most non-natives are better off than most natives. But cultural poverty is becoming universal now. As we grind towards monoculture, towards one brand name, human. I think we are all, native and non-native, involved in change. And as Andy Hope has pointed out, there's no room there for romanticism. So it seems to me, and I put this forward with many, many question marks, it seems to me there must be, let's say, three steps towards what I'm calling conversation on the native side. It being for the natives to tell non-natives what steps to take on their own side. Because unless we say what we think and you say what you think, I don't see how any talk can ever happen. The first step is that native art and native aesthetics must be owned and possessed and defined and created by natives alone. It is very late, but perhaps not too late, for native economic power as it is now to preserve what is still in hand, to buy back if necessary, and however painfully, what can still be bought back, and to attend to the problem of creation of new art in relation both to its own traditions and to the outside world. I have some further ideas in detail on that, if I can speak again at some point. But I do not see how it can ever be done without complete native ownership of those things which can still be owned and reclaimed. After this first step, the second step is to take from the rest of the world whatever is needed. The books are there, education is there, travel is there, and I know that the regional corporations here are making initial moves in that direction, sending people out, sending native students out to take what they need. As far as art is concerned, the whole question of whether or not a native art, one, could, and two, should enter universal art is raised by this second step. In discussion, it would be important to raise these questions perhaps under some such heading as metropolitan versus regional art, or something of that sort. There is a definite question, as the previous speakers pointed out, a question of choice which cannot be made by anybody else than the owners. Whether they are to keep that for themselves or to send it out into the world. I think that it should be sent out into the world, but it is not my business to decide that. I can only say and ask the question. The third step is one that I can only hope and pray for. It is that once native art has done all this, then it goes out to teach. It knows it can teach what technological civilization is doing to destroy the earth. It knows biology and ecology as well or better than non-natives do. The book about Etok, Edwardson, made this clear to me recently. It can question the disappearance of diversity, question the monolithic growth of consumerist progress, so-called. It can say that in the thousands of years mankind has been around, it has been around longest. That its poems and art objects have been around longest, that a major part of human time has been devoted to subsistence living, and that we non-natives have forgotten too much for anyone's good, including our own. And then if native culture does that, it might meet non-native men and women who believe that we are all native or that none of us are native, which is perhaps the same thing. That there are universal criteria for these things, that respect for all of life, the preparation of one's own mind to be a singer for all of life, for the Mother Earth, for the encounter of self and other in all the wildernesses, inner and outer, is the key to true progress, and that in the vast perspective of human time, what is before us rather than behind us, we are all children with everything to learn. And then we shall have conversation, perhaps. And then translation will end as a duty and become a labor of love, and then poetry will begin.
A tribute to a man that always will be King Yamapa, Mr. Sam Cooke. The song that he wrote, I think if he was here, we'd sing it like this.
The things that I see as a walk on the street, that's heaven to me. A little flower that blew away, a lovely sunset at the end of the day, someone to help a stranger along the way, that's heaven to me.
Listen to me. Feeling I have when I hear a touching prayer makes me know that God's somewhere near. Even the birds flying up in the air, that's heaven to me.
Let me a miracle for me to see. The goodness of our love. Even the children play in the street, saying a friendly hello to everyone that they meet. Even the leaves growing on the tree, that's heaven to me.
Bit of Bobby Womack. Former president of AFN, Roger Lang, spoke about education in Alaska and standards that we live by in the system.
Part of the problem, and one of the reasons why I'm up here, is simply because in order to teach and in order to be a certificated teacher, I guess is what I need to say, you have to meet certain standards. Those standards are not set by Alaska Natives. Those standards are set by system, just as steep in tradition as ours is, founded on a principle which perpetuates the system rather than finishes a product, where in order to teach, all you need is a piece of paper, not the need or the urge or the tradition to teach, but a piece of paper. And in order to get the paper, you have to sit 4 years in a chair. But that's how you get to be a teacher and fit their system. That's part of the problem today of being an Alaska Native. That if their system doesn't fit ours, and if their tradition doesn't fit our tradition, how then do we answer the problem of creating our own teacher? We can learn a lot by looking at what's happening. And it's been my privilege, because of some positions that I've been in the last few years, to be able to compare what other people are doing through educational processes to what we were doing to ourselves in America and in Alaska. Someday you ought to see Greenland. They educate from kindergarten through master's degree programs only in Eskimo. If you want to go to their university, you learn their language. And the things that we think as far out and radical in the delivery of education have not only been thought of, but are being done by other people. Things are changing in Alaska, but very slowly, because it's hard to change systems. There are too many people dedicated to the preservation of a system rather than through the delivery of service.
That was Roger Lang. Our next segment features the past president of Inupiat University of the Arctic, the late Bill Vaudrin.
I think in the early days of bilingual education, we used to think translating anything into the native language was a step forward. And yet consider a story such as Goldilocks and the Three Bears, where a girl is lost out in the woods, she's hungry, she's tired, she comes on a home, there's no one there. She's very scared. She opens the door, goes in, and finds food on the table, but she feels guilty about, you know, sitting down to eat the food. She feels guilty about laying down in the bed to rest. The whole story is based on values completely foreign to Yupik culture, that if any Yupik Eskimo traveling on Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta were out lost and cold and tired and hungry and came on a cabin, the expectation would be, the value system of the people in that area would be, that that person would be welcome to come in to eat, to sleep, to rest. So that having translated a foreign story based on a foreign value system is more destructive, in that it's in the native language now, it's more acceptable in a sense, more people can listen to it, more people can take it to themselves and make that part of them. And yet, is that something that really should be made part of them? Maybe if it's taught as a foreign studies course or part of a curriculum of looking out at the world the way that the world typically looks in at Alaska Natives. Our primary goal is to provide the kind of education that will enable graduates of Inupiat University to live comfortably in any of the variety of lifestyles it is likely they will choose among during their lifetimes, ranging from the traditional subsistence way of life of the early Inupiat to urban technocratic society, and including any combination of the two. We don't believe it's any more ethical for us than it is for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to predetermine for students, by what we teach or don't teach, the kinds of lives that they will lead. However, we do feel an obligation to assure that their choices in that regard are based on a working knowledge of a heritage and a system of values that has withstood the tests of time and adversity like few others, and not merely endured but prevailed, the way of the Arctic Slope in Inupiat.
Was a lady and the time I used to know. I think that I've been on the road too long. Scenes of better days are pictured in my head and haunting me those old familiar songs. Oh, sweet Jesus, hear me cry.
sweet Jesus, hear me cry. Let me see a clearer sky. For tomorrow I may be back home again. So take the shadow.
Continuing on the topic of education, Richard Burmeister heads up the Indian Ed program at NOM, and he told about the subjects taught by the Northwest Natives.
We have 15 pairs of snowshoes being constructed by the students, and they are learning, and they will be able to pass it on. A berry bucket. You don't see too many berry buckets around. I saw the first one in a long time over at the museum here the other day when I was over there. Paul Nagoric is one of the last people also to construct berry buckets. We had 36 berry buckets made in the classroom this year. One student made one, and now he's in the process of making more for his, another one for his grandmother, and another one for his mother. Going into skin sewing, sinew making. We had sinew making within the classroom, and one of the girls went home at Christmas time. This was last year. It was the first time that she's ever made sinew, and she came home and she sat down. Her mother was going to make some mukluks and was making sinew also, and she sat down and made sinew with her mother, and her mother says, "Where in the world did you learn how to do that?" And she said, "I learned it in class." And it was very pleasing to her mother and very pleasing that she had a chance also to make sinew. We make kayaks. Students showed an interest and wanted to know how to make a kayak. We brought in a lay instructor to work with the students. The sinew that the students made went into sewing of the kayak here. One of the students went back this summer and made a kayak and used it during seal hunting in the early fall. Dog sled construction. Fred Armstrong is a permanent employee of the program, and his expertise is dog sled making. We have right now 20 dog sleds in the process of being made, and we have over 50 students interested in making them. We figure by the end of this year we'll have 75 dog sleds constructed, and each student is allowed to make one dog sled. We buy the materials for the first one, and after that, if they want to make any more, they have to buy the materials for it. Students work very hard on it. Fred doesn't let them get by with doing a easy job or a sloppy job. If they don't do it properly the first time, he requires them to go back and do it over and over until it's done correctly. Also, we go out and we've been running dogs. We bring the dogs to school. The students that are interested in handling dogs and working with dogs will handle them. Some of the students showed an interest in learning how to make hand tools for carving ivory. So we went up to Diomede, got a person for this, and made our tools, and the students made their tools for carving. We made a toboggan out of baleen. It's used for pulling the seals after seal hunt. Last spring, we had a chance by invitation to go out to gamble on a whale hunt. We took 15 students out to gamble, and some of the students were girls, and went out there and got ready to go on a whale hunt. This girl here, June Lincoln, is very much interested in learning everything she can, including whale hunting. And the captains of the boat really more or less don't want to take women out on whale hunt because it's a little too rough. Well, she said she could outdo any man, and she proved during that week that she could. Got the boats ready, and we went out. We did a lot of viewing out there and spent many hours, up to 18 to 20 hours, out looking for the whales. Communication by radio most of the time between the whalers. This is one of the students that found out if he puts an oar paddle or a piece of wood down the water, he can listen to either the whales or the seals talking. And every time we came to a piece of ice looking for, going to go up and look for whales, he was down in the water listening for them. But he said, I'll find them one way, you find them the other.
The Carpenters. Native artist Larry Avakanov Barrow talked about his education, his experiences in art, and the materials that he uses.
I went to several art schools and had the training of the Western style, the European style of creating something in a different material. I never worked with ivory until recently. I only work with different materials like stone. Stone carving was not part of our culture, but still I'm part of that culture because I am one of the feelings within me when I see a picture of my grandfather or something, and the feeling I get within me is very strong. So just the idea of being an artist, it was so important to me, and the idea of being a native artist was a step that I didn't want to take until recently, because I felt a need that I wanted to grow within myself. A stone piece out of marble, it's one of the hardest materials I've ever found to work with, and it is the most important material with, that I feel I want to use, because of the hardness of it, the feeling that when I make something, it can last for extremely a long time. As you know, that the Egyptian art and a lot of the stone sculpture that a lot of the Indians have made, especially the Aztecs and such, to know more about oneself is very important within these materials. And all the material I've ever used were foreign to our people, so I had to take one more step into knowing my strength, into developing it. I had a very, very good respect for a lot of the Indian cultures down in New Mexico, in the Southwest area, and I got a lot of feeling from them because they helped me to understand about myself. I'm also did glass blowing. I developed a glass blowing workshop up in Barrow. It's the northernmost glass shop in the world, and it's the only glass shop that any ethnic group has ever put together that is away from the Western glass blowing type of techniques. And I developed this through the help of many instructors and friends, especially friends.
Larry tells the story of the little people and how he created the sculpture about them.
I heard, kind of offhand, a story that there was these little people that come in the night, or that's going to steal your food from you if you don't lock it up. And these little people, I didn't know what they'd really look like, and a lot of people told me that they have no hair on the head, or they have a lot of hair on their body, but kind of a funny-looking little thing. So I wanted to capture an idea, a feeling, that to really put down a thought, a visual thought of what somebody is saying, it's very hard to do that. But I got an idea of using this little creature in my own way and capturing it. It's just frozen. It has a fish in its mouth. It's ready to bite it, ready to eat it. And somebody has caught this little person in the act of stealing, and he's very, very, his eyes are very open, very aware that he's being peered at. And I always get the feeling sometimes that I'm being peered at, because I'm working with strange materials and strange ideas that a lot of my people don't really understand. And they just kind of, they look at it and they just kind of get, they don't have nothing to say, you know. They get so dumbfounded sometimes when I'm doing something strange. So this is the feeling I like to get as a story behind something, not just being an object. It's a growing, living thing. It's not just an object. It's an idea of one person.
That was Larry Avakana. I'm Moses Wasley, and thank you for listening.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.